The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hi, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Marie-Claire Shanahan, guest hosting today for Desiree Shell. Today I'm really pleased to welcome Sean Carroll. Sean is a physicist and senior research associate at the California Institute of Technology. There, he studies such small matters as the origin of the universe. He's also a skilled science writer and communicator, and his most recent book is The Particle at the End of the Universe: How the Higgs Boson Leads Us to the Edge of a New World. It tells the story of the people and science behind the Large Hadron Collider and the search for the Higgs boson. Welcome, Sean. It's really terrific to have you here.
Hi. Good to be here, Marie-Claire.
So as soon as I heard about the book, this is actually the first question I've been wanting to ask you for a while. When did you decide to write this? Because we don't usually get to read books about scientific discoveries in the year that they happen. Was this already in the works, or how did this happen?
It was certainly already in the works. There's no way. In fact, I think that the completed manuscript got to the publisher close to the end of July, and the announcement was on July 4th. So no, I did not write the whole book in 3 weeks. That was not going to happen. Basically, what happened was last December, a year ago, in 2011, there were two seminars at CERN, at the Large Hadron Collider, where they updated us on the data so far. And there was an unmistakable hint of Higgs boson in the air in that data. Not enough to claim a discovery, but it was more or less what we were looking for, more or less where we would look for it. And we knew that in 2012, there'd be a lot more data coming in. So the smart money said that the Higgs boson would be discovered at the end of 2012. Now, the smart money would have been wrong because the Higgs boson was discovered by July, and that took everybody by surprise. But at least the idea was that I started writing the book in January or February, roughly speaking, and it's still very, very fast to write a book.
Yeah.
But the hope was that it would come out around the time that the announcement was being made. But the physics and nature conspired against me there.
They pushed your timeline forward a little bit, or they had their own timeline, didn't they?
They had their own timeline, as the universe often does, yes.
Yes. Well, undoubtedly, it's one of the biggest science stories of 2012. There's no doubt about that. And as it was announced, and I think even with some of those earlier announcements, we all saw and heard lots of different ways that people took trying to describe what this discovery really was. What is Higgs boson? What were they doing at the Large Hadron Collider? And I think some of those have been successful and some of them maybe less so. What have you found to be sort of the clearest and best way of telling us what's really going on?
Well, there's so much going on that it depends on where you want to angle into it. Mm-hmm. In the book, I very explicitly start by not really trying to explain the Higgs boson and spontaneous symmetry breaking and the other ideas that a theoretical physicist would instantly leap to, but instead just trying to convey some of the grandeur and scope of the experiment itself, the Large Hadron Collider, the largest machine ever built by human beings, and the story that got us there. But then, you know, So hopefully the audience is roped in, and then I try to actually hit them with the theoretical physics, which they've all been waiting for, I'm sure. I haven't answered your question yet, but which question do you want me to answer? Do you want me to answer why the LHC is amazing or why the Higgs boson is amazing?
Well, I'd love to hear about both, actually, but let's start with the Higgs boson first.
The reason why it's hard to explain the Higgs boson in 10 seconds or less is because it's not the Higgs boson that is really important.
Mm-hmm.
What is important about the Higgs boson is that it's evidence for a Higgs field filling all of space. And to a particle physicist, that's not surprising because all particles come from fields. Photons come from the electromagnetic fields. Even things like electrons and quarks and neutrinos, they all come from fields filling space. But we never tell anybody this. So now that the Higgs boson is around, it's not the particle that's very important. It's the field filling space that's important. And we have to sort of back up and explain that. So the important thing about the Higgs boson discovery is that empty space is filled with this invisible energy field. And it has crucial effects on the other particles and forces of nature. It was invented because it helps explain why the weak nuclear force is short range, why it's only confined inside the nucleus of an atom, why it doesn't stretch out, you know, from person to person across large distances. And as a benefit, as a side benefit, it explains why other particles of nature, like the electron, for example, have mass. Without that Higgs field filling space interacting with the electron, electrons would be moving at the speed of light, which means that they would not settle into atoms, which means that there would be no chemistry, so you would have had a very different career. There would be no molecules, there would be no life, because electrons would all be moving at the speed of light. So the Higgs field filling space is this idea they came up with in the early 60s. It's mind-boggling if it's true, and the experiments in July 2012 showed us that it looks like it's true.
So that's why we're all very excited.
That's why we're all very excited. You know, there's many ways, once again, to emphasize how exciting it is. It's 100,000 years from now, when they talk about the history of particle physics, they will talk about pre-Higgs boson discovery and post-Higgs boson discovery, because this puts the final piece of the standard model of particle physics together. And the standard models, you know, this very boringly named theory that we have, describes ordinary matter, you know, atoms and things like that, quarks, leptons, all the particles that we know really exist. It doesn't describe dark matter, quantum gravity, things like that, but it just does describe everything that you and I are made of, which means that we right now, for the first time in human history, have a completely effective and reliable theory of the stuff that we are made of. So that is a very important intellectual achievement.
That is really, really cool.
It is. Yes, good.
Now, one of the things I think that you're sort of saying there is also that it's so big that it's a little bit difficult to explain, because it really does rely on having a very particular type of understanding about fields and about what particles are and about what matter is. There's kind of all these steps in a way that you have to get to. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. And, you know, one of the things that I think that physicists should learn from this is that one of the things we need to popularize is the idea of quantum field theory. You know, it sounds very intimidating, but we write all sorts of books on quantum mechanics, on relativity, for that matter, string theory, the multiverse, the Big Bang, and whatever. And we don't write popular books or articles or blog posts about quantum field theory. But if you're a theoretical physicist or an experimental particle physicist, quantum field theory is your bread and butter stuff. It's what the world is made of. It's our best understanding of nature at a fundamental level. And there are features of quantum field theory that are really, really important, such as understanding how the Higgs boson and the Higgs field work. So I'm hoping for a slight shift in emphasis of our traditional stock way of popularizing modern physics, trying to switch its emphasis more to explaining how fields work, because they're so important.
You're pretty direct in the book sometimes, too, that while it's difficult, as you just said, there's really opportunities. And one of the things you said that really kind of struck me as important was you want to say things that are completely correct, of course, but you also...
Nice, yes.
Yes, that is important. but you also want to give people the right impression, which isn't the same thing.
That's right. And, you know, if you're a conscientious expert in any field, physics is just, you know, one of the more abstract fields, but if you're an expert trying to explain things to a broad audience, you know what's correct and incorrect. And you know that when you're trying to say it in ordinary language, there will be compromises, right? You don't get to use equations or jargon or anything like that. And so usually the tendency is to try to say things in ordinary language for which at least one interpretation of the word that you're saying would be correct. And it doesn't mean that that's the interpretation that the audience is actually going to receive, but it's at least one you can defend to your friends and colleagues, because you can say, well, what I meant was this, right? And that's very different than sort of trying to talk to a person, you know, and people are not blank slates. They have some idea about how the world works already. And to try to do the best job you possibly can to get them closer to the correct idea. And that might not be a straight line from where they are to the completely correct idea. You might need to sort of lead them along the path of least resistance.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with Sean Carroll, physicist and science writer, and author of The Particle at the End of the Universe, about the Large Hadron Collider and the search for the Higgs boson. I asked you a question before, and you said that you could answer it for the Higgs or for the Large Hadron Collider itself. Why don't we turn our attention there for now? Because a lot of the book isn't just about the Higgs. It's actually about the construction of the LHC in Switzerland, as you said, the largest machine ever, which is pretty cool. And you've called it an inspiring embodiment of the human passion for discovery. It's a pretty lofty description.
Well, I think it's utterly accurate. I'm happy to stand by that because, as you know, another inevitable question is, so now that we've discovered the Higgs boson, what are we going to do with it? Is it going to cure cancer? Is it going to help me fly? What are we going to get out of this wonderful discovery? And the very likely answer is nothing at all. We'll get spin-offs from the technology because when you put money into basic research, it always comes back worth more than you put into it. So we've greatly improved our ability to send data across large distances, to build large superconducting magnets. Various other technological achievements were pushed by the LHC. But really, it was about understanding the universe. That's really why we did it. The passion for discovery was the primary motivation for building this $9 billion particle physics experiment under the ground in France and Switzerland. So I'm all in favor of being honest about that, not pretending that it's about building jetpacks or anything like that, which is why I put the cartoon in there from Saturday morning breakfast cereal that, you know, the scientists aren't really about the ultimate applications, even though they know that they're there. They're about understanding how the universe works, and that's what this machine does for us.
That's a pretty cool testament to human curiosity, I think.
I think so, and I think we have to be honest that it's not always an easy sell. You know, when you're in graduate school in physics, you learn how to do your Feynman diagrams and calculate your cross sections and build your scintillation detectors, and then you grow up to be the boss of a big project and you have to wheedle finance ministers of skeptical countries into giving you $1 billion to look for a particle that you can't explain to them very well. And it's, you know, it's not what we're selected or trained to do, but that's the kind of thing that had to happen. You know, I tell lots of stories in the book. One is that while digging part of the tunnel, they run into an ancient Roman ruin from the year 400 AD, and they have to stop while the physicists go away and the archaeologists come in. They have to deal with the fact that West Germany and East Germany are reuniting, and that's tremendously expensive, and suddenly Germany is a lot less interested in paying money for particle physics when they're trying to pay money for healthcare and, you know, good roads in the eastern half of their country. So it is, you know, it takes years to do it. It takes enormous dedication. The payoff is clear to the experts, but hard to make clear to other people. So it is an amazing testament that nevertheless, we human beings did this pretty impressive thing.
It really is. And my background originally is in mechanical engineering. So I'll be honest, the part that really grabbed, parts that really grabbed me that I almost would stop and tell whoever I was sitting beside, you won't believe this, were all the little fixes, the little like tricks that they use to make things work or to figure out how to test things. Do you have any favorite stories from doing that kind of that part of the research?
I mean, the ping pong ball is pretty awesome, you have to admit.
It is.
I'm a theoretical physicist. Like I said somewhere in the book, I think that the health hazard that we face is, you know, caffeine overdose or bad posture or something like that. But so I was very much a tourist or a journalist when it came to learning about and explaining the experimental and the engineering side. And to me, it was just all amazing. So I hope that some of my amazement came through.
It did.
And the one example that just blew me away, so I had to include it when I heard it, was you have a 17-mile ring underground, or 27 kilometers, they say in the developed world, and it's a small tube, two small tubes through which the protons go, and they need to be completely empty. You're going to evacuate it. It's a better vacuum than the atmosphere of the moon. But in the course of building things, you know, a little dust, a little scrap of paper might find its way into the tube. And this actually happened at the Tevatron and Fermilab. And then you don't know where it is. It's somewhere along this 27-kilometer tube. So they needed to make sure that the beam pipe was empty. So they had a brilliant idea. It was about the size of a ping pong ball, the beam pipe. So they made a ping pong ball, but in it they put a radio receiver. and they just shot it along the beam pipe, and they let it roll. And if it hit something, it would beep and tell them that they should go to this location and try to fix it there before the protons bumped into the thing. And then fortunately, or unfortunately for us storytellers, it didn't find anything. The pipe was perfectly clear. But it's that kind of, you know, very practical wisdom that separates the really successful experimental physicists from the people who know what they should do but can't pull it off quite as successfully.
I had a lab professor who always told us that half of what we did, half of it was the art of tinkering and the other half was science. And I thought that came through in some of those cool little stories.
Yeah, it's absolutely true, because you can't be taught that, right? Mm-hmm. You can sort of learn a little bit from experience what kinds of things you're going to face. But this is, by definition, a very unique challenge, building something like the LHC. And especially when everyone is looking over you. It's not like you're working in secret. Lynn Evans, who is the boss of the LHC, tells a story. The last time that CERN turned on a new proton hadron collider was in the early 1980s. And it was he and Carlo Rubbia and one other physicist at 4 a.m. And they sort of flipped the switch and it went on. And then they, you know, popped the champagne and went home. Whereas when they turned on the LHC, there was a webcast. Hundreds of thousands of people were watching. All of the news stories were front page news the next day. So there was a lot of pressure on everyone doing it. And I thought they came through very, very well.
Yeah, I remember actually there was a lot of excitement around it when it opened. It was built up to be as exciting as it has been.
Yeah, I mean, we need to do that because we would like someday to build another one, or at least another particle accelerator to look at the discoveries we make at the LHC. So, I mean, I didn't want to dwell on this because it can become a bit of a downer, but it's still a very realistic process that the LHC is the last large particle accelerator built in our lifetimes. Mm-hmm. These things are expensive. We're not in an economic situation where countries are looking to spend money on big projects, and we need some results. And so the Higgs boson was a godsend for that reason, and we're hoping to get a lot more. And we also need to do our work to convince people that this is stuff that is worth getting excited about.
Actually, kind of jumping off from that, it kind of seems like a difficult story to tell without coming back to questions about, you know, relationships between science and government, industry, public funding, policy. What do you think are some of the big challenges in those areas right now?
One thing is perfectly clear is that if there ever will be another large particle accelerator, it will be an international project. The United States tried to take the lead on the superconducting supercollider, and they lost their nerve halfway through and canceled it after spending literally billions of dollars. And so that was kind of a messy disaster. The LHC, on the other hand, has been international from start to finish. CERN is by itself an international organization in Europe, and they were very happy to take input and money and help from the rest of the world. And whatever comes next will also be international, and that's easy to say, but it's going to be located somewhere, right? So some place is going to get to say, well, we have it. And so some country or some region is going to have to step up and say, we're going to take the initiative here, and we need international cooperation. And other countries are going to have to say, we're going to give you $1 billion even though it's not located here. And that has good parts and bad parts. I mean, a good part is that there's a certain, you know, social pressure on countries to go along. If everyone else has agreed to do this and you've agreed to do this, you can't sort of decide to drop out without annoying everybody else. On the other hand, in the United States, we developed quite a reputation for dropping out halfway through. So who knows whether we still have the capacity to be embarrassed about these things anymore. There is talk that Japan might be interested in hosting a large particle collider as part of the recovery efforts after the tsunami. You know, they're looking for things to do to spend money to create jobs in their country to put themselves back on the right track, and this would be an excellent choice. China has mumbled about it. Europe would not mind. The United States would certainly love to have it, although they don't want to pay the money for it. So we'll have to see. It's going to require a great amount of political acumen as well as physics knowledge to get it done.
That makes sense. These projects are really big. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'll be right back with Sean Carroll, physicist, science writer, and author of The Particle at the End of the Universe.
Skeptically,
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Marie-Claire Shanahan, guest host this week for Desiree Schell. Today I'm talking to physicist and science writer Sean Carroll about his book, The Particle at the End of the Universe: How the Higgs Boson Leads Us to the Edge of a New World. Sean is a research associate at the California Institute of Technology, blogs at The Preposterous Universe, and also is the author of From Eternity to Here, The Quest for the Ultimate Theory of Time. Okay, so we were just talking about having to have a pretty big international commitment from these. These colliders are expensive, they're difficult to build, they really do require a lot of buy-in.
Right.
But you also spend a lot of time in the book talking about the importance of particle physics and projects like the LHC. Is that a question that people seem to ask a lot? Like, why create these expensive experiments to study particles that aren't going to give us jetpacks or other sort of very immediate benefits?
It is, and they should ask that. It's absolutely their right to do it. I mean, the cost of the LHC is, you know, the cost of an aircraft carrier, of which we have many. And it's much, much less than the cost of something like the International Space Station or a month of the Iraq War or something like that. So it's not as if it's a large fraction of what governments spend their money on by any stretch of the imagination. But it is publicly funded, and it sort of must be. No one is going to give $10 billion, no individual human being, to do particle physics. So it's a social good. It is a democratically chosen thing that we take, you know, some fraction of our tax dollars and put it towards absolutely basic research. And the LHC is a big, hard to miss example of that. But there's lots of examples of basic research that no person would fund for immediate technological benefit, but is still very interesting to fund. So I think that the side of the social contract that we scientists are on is that If we get money from the taxpayers and citizens of the world to go out and figure out the secrets of the universe, once we figure some of them out, we need to go back and tell them what we have figured out. So, I mean, I think that's as much fun as I had writing the book, and even though I was actually paid to do it, I also think that I'm trying to do a good deed, trying to help explain to people why this really was so important. I think that's not a project that ends anytime. It's just something that goes on, and we need to keep trying to do better and better.
That makes sense. This is all part of that larger project of doing basic research and also being part of communicating it back to those who fund it.
Yeah. If you talk to particle physicists, many of them reach for analogies with art or music or literature. Mm-hmm. Now, admittedly, art, music, and literature are cheaper than particle physics, but it's the same kind of impulse that is being reached. You know, we're trying to – As Robert Wilson said in the famous quote that I did quote, you know, he was bugged when he was building Fermilab in the late 1960s by a member of Congress about how this is going to help defend the country. And he says, no, it's not going to help to defend the country. It helps make the country worth defending. And I think that we should just be honest about that, and that's okay. On the other hand, someone can say, well, why don't we spend $9 billion on better music or something like that? And the answer there is that it's either you spend the $9 billion or you don't get any result. If you spend $4.5 billion, you don't get half a Higgs boson. You get nothing. So we can still do good art and music and literature without spending $9 billion, but we can't discover the Higgs boson without that kind of investment.
That makes sense. I want to turn back now to look at actually what they did do there. As you said in the book, you can't find half a Higgs boson. And even with $9 million, you can't exactly find it. You can't just open up the accelerator and see what's inside and there will be a boson sitting there for you to look at.
That's awesome. But no, yeah.
You can't even get a photograph of it, really. Tell us a bit about what is the actual evidence that you get out of something like the LHC?
You know, for me, in some sense, this is my favorite set of chapters in the book where I do talk mm-hmm. about that, because there's all sorts of choices that are made when you design an experiment, and ultimately they all are governed by the laws of physics. You know, when we smash two protons together, well, let's back up a little bit. So let's say there is a Higgs boson and we're looking for it and we want to know how to find it. How do we make one? There are no Higgs bosons living inside of protons or electrons or other particles. What we're doing is we're taking advantage of E equals MC squared, that energy is equal to mass for an object that isn't sitting, that is just sitting still. So if you want to make a massive particle like the Higgs boson, a very heavy particle, what you need is you squeeze a lot of energy into a very small region of space. And the best way we can do that is just smashing particles together with a huge velocity, so they have a tremendous amount of energy. Then the problem is that, number one, you make a Higgs boson because these protons smashed together and started the Higgs field vibrating. Number one, it decays away almost instantly. In one zeptosecond, that Higgs boson is gone. So you're not seeing a picture of the Higgs boson. You can't even detect its existence directly. All you can see is what it decays into. Number two, you don't know what it decays into with perfect precision. Sometimes it will decay into some things, bottom quarks, tau leptons. Other times it will decay into gluons or photons or something like that. So you need to look at all the different possibilities. Number three, whatever the Higgs boson can decay into, there are other ways of making exactly that same thing. So creating two photons is the most effective way that we have right now of finding Higgs bosons. But there's many other particle interactions that would create two photons coming out with high energy. So the analogy that I stole from somebody else in the book is that it's not like looking for a needle in a haystack, because at least you know when you found the needle. It's like looking for hay in a haystack, because there's a little bit more hay with a certain length per stalk than there is than you would expect just from statistics. So there's a few more events with two photons coming out than you would otherwise expect. So it's all about statistics, understanding your backgrounds, all that grungy stuff that makes your eyes glaze over as an undergraduate when you're doing physics labs. This is what really matters here at the LHC.
I really like that description of the hay. I could just, you can kind of imagine somebody laying all the hay out and comparing it.
And it's very much like that. That's right.
Yeah, I think it gives a good indication of what an immense amount of work actually goes into these discoveries.
Yeah, and also, you only have a small number of tools to work with. The Higgs boson is created, and then it decays almost instantly. And, well, what can it decay into? It can decay into the particles that we know and love. And some of those decay very rapidly themselves, like a bottom quark or a W boson just decays right away into something else. So we build these detectors, these experiments at the LHC, in a very predictable logical way, because we know what all the possible particles that could be detected will look like. There's electrons, there's photons, there's muons, and there are hadrons, the strongly interacting particles, the protons and neutrons and pions and so forth. And that's it. Those are the only particles that can be made that we could possibly detect. So we build this onion-shaped thing where there's different layers. The inner layer looks at the electrons and photons. The next layer looks at the hadrons, the strongly interacting particles. And the next layer looks at the muons, which can punch through the furthest. And it all makes sense just because of, ultimately, the laws of physics, which I just think is a fascinating reflection of the very small controlling the very large.
Very, very neat stuff. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with Sean Carroll, physicist, science writer, and author of The Particle at the End of the Universe, about the Large Hadron Collider and the search for the Higgs boson. So you just told us about your analogy, the haystack, which I really liked. You also, in the book, talk a little bit about how looking for the Higgs is a bit like looking for fossil evidence.
Yeah, it's a lot like looking for that, because for a few reasons. the thing I was actually trying to get across there is that it's hard. That if you've ever been out there digging up fossils, especially very old ones, you know, dinosaur kind of fossils, the chemical reactions between the bones and the earth have been going on for a long time, and it's really hard to distinguish the fossil from just a rock around it, from the matrix, as they call it, as it were. And likewise, when you look at these events in a particle accelerator, it's very hard to distinguish the events that are interesting from the events that are just background, just noise. And thank goodness we have two large, complex, general-purpose experiments at the LHC. We have CMS and ATLAS, as their acronyms are, and they do more or less the same thing, but in slightly different ways, so they can check each other's work. So if you only had one experiment like that at the LHC, something unique that could was the only thing on Earth that could do this kind of work, people would be a lot more skeptical that we had really found something. It's just too easy to trick yourself. So the fact that we have two experiments getting the same answer is very, very helpful when it comes to making sure that we're on the right track.
Cool. You mentioned it's a little easier to trick ourselves, and you describe in the book doing the analysis of these things blind. Mm-hmm. You know, I do some research with students, and doing that blind would mean, you know, maybe I give them three different versions of something to read, and I make sure that the data I collect at the end, I can't tell which version they've read until I've analyzed them all, so that I don't, you know, look at the ones I'm hoping are going to be better and then maybe find something that's not really there. So I sort of blind myself to what version they got to read. Mm-hmm. What does the blinding mean in terms of the type of data that you're taking out of the collider?
Well, it means a few things. The problem is that we don't actually have the ability to calculate with high degree of reliability how many events of each kind you should see at the Large Hadron Collider. So let's say that you're looking for events, like we said, where two very energetic photons come out. The problem is you're colliding protons together, and protons are a mess. Protons have quarks inside and gluons, and it's not the protons that actually smash into each other. It's the little pieces of proton inside one of them that smash into the pieces inside the other one. And this happens via the strong interactions very often. And the strong interactions are strong, which means it's hard to calculate things very reliably. So it's hard to make predictions just a priori. And then once it happens, you need to really understand your detector, your experiment. I mean, some of that particle production is just going to go down the beam pipe or through a crack in the detector, or maybe one of your little wires isn't working that day. And there's a million other ways that things could be thrown off ever so slightly. And when you're looking for something like the Higgs boson, which is literally, you know, it gets made one out of every 10 billion events that you look at, you better have your statistical control very, very accurate. So what they do is they look everywhere where they don't expect to see a Higgs boson. They look at the other energies where they think that they have everything under control, and there they try to figure out how much background they have. And ideally, you do that sort of on both sides in some parameter of where you're actually going to start looking. And you do all that, and you make sure that you have a firm prediction for what you should see where you're looking for the Higgs or whatever you're looking for, and only then do you allow yourself to look at the data that is actually relevant to the thing you're looking at. So you open the box, as it is called. Before then, you're not allowed to mess with the parameters that are going into your fit. So that you make sure that if you do open the box and there's something there, that it's because it's really there, not just because you sort of sneakily willed it into existence.
Making sure that sort of a background and other things that you're not mistaking those for effects. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, my favorite example, I ended up not finding room for this in the book, but a great example of a blind analysis is the Pepsi Challenge. I don't know if you remember this from back in the day. So, you know, they had people in supermarkets test two colas, and at the time Coke was a lot more popular than Pepsi, and they gave them two things in, you know, paper bags. You couldn't tell which one it was. And in this blind analysis, they ended up picking the Pepsi a lot more often than the Coke. Now, it was later revealed that the paper bag containing the Pepsi was labeled with the letter M, and the paper bag containing the Coke was labeled with the letter Q. And it turns out that M is just a much more favorable letter than Q is. So despite the fact that they had supposedly hidden the identity, in fact, they had very, very gently made the Pepsi a little bit more desirable. And so there's all sorts of ways you can trick yourself, either intentionally or unintentionally. So we have two experiments. They would both like to beat each other and get the result first. It's a very spirited but friendly competition. And ultimately, you're going to get so much data that you just can't be wrong, so you might as well be right the first time you do it.
I'm just imagining now the people at Pepsi doing a background investigation, just trying to see how many people will choose M over Q, just as a as sort of like the background levels, and
it
then
could just
opening
be
the box.
Some intuitive genius figured it out, or maybe they just got lucky. I don't even know.
Yeah.
But you got to be very careful. That's the double-blindedness is important there.
It really is. Okay, one more fun analogy was, you used this a couple times, was talking about the energy achieved by the colliders in comparison to the motion of a mosquito. Why a mosquito?
It's very small.
Yeah.
It's just, it's hard to convey, because at the same time, the energies are not that much, but they're a lot. And the reason why both of those things can be true is because the energy of one proton zooming around the LHC is nothing on our macroscopic everyday world. You know, if that one proton hit you, you wouldn't notice it. But all of that energy is squeezed into a single proton. That's the trick here. So even in a flea or a mosquito, there are a tremendous number of protons, right? There's 10 to the 20-some protons in there. So anytime you have something large moving slowly, it will very easily have a lot more energy than a single proton moving very, very fast. But what we want for particle physics is to take as much energy we can into a really tiny region of space. And that flying mosquito is just not going to be able to do that.
Well, it's small. It's not that small.
It's not nearly that small. That's right.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with physicist Sean Carroll, and we're talking about the Large Hadron Collider and the discovery of the Higgs boson. We'll be right back after a few moments.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, it's our guide to science books for the 2012 holidays. Whether you're dropping a last-minute hint to a relative or buying books for the people you love, we've got you covered. We've enlisted over a dozen of our favorite past guests to bring you their favorites from 2012 and some classics to help fill out anyone's science library. Happy holidays! That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Marie-Claire Shanahan, guest host this week for Desiree Schell. Today I'm talking to physicist and science writer Sean Carroll about his book, The Particle at the End of the Universe, How the Higgs Boson Leads Us to the Edge of a New World. Sean is a senior research associate at the California Institute of Technology and is also working on a special for PBS's NOVA on the Large Hadron Collider and the search for the Higgs boson, scheduled to air in 2013. So I want to come back to something you mentioned really, really close to the beginning of our chat, which is how the idea of matter and mass is so intricately tied into talking about the Higgs and other particles.
Yeah, this is a whole can of worms, actually.
Yeah.
When I end up giving talks about it. One of the things that people ask is what this has to do with gravity, because they know that gravity has something to do with mass. Mm-hmm. It's gravity, it's mass that causes you to push down on the scales a little bit, right? Or, well, maybe it's weight, people say, but certainly that has something to do with mass. So what does the Higgs boson have to do with gravity? And the answer is nothing at all. Mass is a source for gravity. It's the fact that the Earth that has mass that causes it to have a gravitational field. But you can define what mass is, even if there wasn't any gravity. Even if you're out in space, if you push on a giant spaceship, it's not going to move very fast. If you push on a little wrench flying out there in outer space, you can make it move very fast. The mass is just the resistance to getting something moving. And that's what the Higgs boson gives to the elementary particles. Now, the other source of confusion is, of course, why should you need to explain why particles have mass at all? Why can't they just have it? Why is this something that is a mystery? And that's actually the most complicated thing to explain, because there are deep down symmetries in the standard model that naively prevent all of its particles from having mass. And you wouldn't notice that unless you really dug into how the standard model works. It has to do with the fact that particles spinning clockwise are treated differently than particles spinning counterclockwise in the standard model. One of them feel the weak interactions and the other don't. And so to make them talk to each other, you need to break that symmetry and give them mass. And none of that is very transparent. I can be very clear. You know, it's not, it takes a lot longer to explain. So when people say you need the Higgs boson to give particles mass, it's one of those fake explanations that I really don't like, because you can repeat that back and it sounds like you've understood something. Ah, now I know what the Higgs boson does. It explains why particles have mass. But you don't actually know why you need a Higgs boson to explain why particles have mass. So the illusion of understanding has been created, but no actual understanding there.
And really the important thing in some ways is why you need that to make mass.
Yeah, it's a long, complicated story. And when in the early 1960s, when the first people who invented the Higgs mechanism, and I should say it wasn't just Peter Higgs, although his name gets attached to it, there was a group of at least seven different people who were involved in inventing this. They weren't thinking about how to give mass to the electron or to the up quark or anything like that. They were trying to figure out how to give mass to the, what we now call the W and Z bosons, the bosons that carry the weak nuclear force. There's this weird thing that I have still in my life not yet come up with a good, understandable explanation for, which is forces of nature, electromagnetism, gravity, weak and strong nuclear forces, the symmetries that create them create massless particles. The photon and the graviton really are massless, as is the gluon that carries the strong force. It's only the weak nuclear force that has massive bosons carrying its force. And so that's what they wanted to explain. It was only a bonus. It came later on, 5 years later, I guess only 3 years later, Steven Weinberg figured out that he could understand the weak interactions and how ordinary particles got mass as well by using the same trick that Higgs and his friends had used. So I put all that in an appendix in my book. I don't think that it's very easy going. And so I think that the real, you know, the most important thing, single fact to grasp about the Higgs is that there is a field pervading space. That's the most important thing to get. It affects all the other particles that move through it. Everything else is a detail that you can sort of save for later contemplation.
Fair enough. When it comes to mass, though, that's sort of one of the defining features. When we teach kids, like, you know, really early on, how to decide what's matter, we usually define it as, you know, anything that has mass and anything that takes up space.
Right.
And
yeah, those are not very good definitions.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what do you think about that?
200 years ago, that would have been fine. And most of us live in a world that is pretty accurately described by 200-year-old physics, really, right? Mm-hmm. In fact, probably 2,000-year-old physics for most of the time. But we know a little bit more now. And so what happens is, as science goes on, we often change the meaning of the concepts a little bit, but keep the same words. And Thomas Kuhn would have explained why you really shouldn't do that, but it's going to be inevitably done. So we use the word mass a little bit differently now than we used to, especially because of relativity, which taught us that there is such a thing as a massless particle, and a massless particle will always move at the speed of light. Mm-hmm. Photons, the particles of light itself, move at the speed of light and have no mass. Likewise, gravitons, the particles of gravity, do the same thing. So that's just not a concept that would have entered into a Newtonian conception of how things are going. And part of that relativity revolution that Einstein gave us says that, you know, energy is more important than mass. In fact, the real way of thinking about E equals mc squared is not that energy is a form of mass, but that mass is a form of energy. That what you call mass is just the energy an object has when it's not moving. That's what the mass is. And if it is moving, it has a different energy. It has more energy. And there are some things that are always moving because they're moving at the speed of light, and therefore they have no mass whatsoever. So mass is sort of a secondary characteristic of a lot of particles. And if you really want to get into what matter is and so forth, you got to start talking about quantum field theory, and that's a whole nother thing.
And that's usually not where we start our fifth grade science classes.
It's usually not. And that's why, you know, we have to undo some of the damage later on, because, you know, at some point, if you take enough physics, you'll be faced with the puzzle, is light a particle or a wave? And usually you will come out the other side not understanding what the answer is to that question. It can be very, very confusing because you know, the arguments are given on both sides and it's never quite clear what the resolution was. And the resolution is that light is a wave. That's what it is. In fact, the resolution is deeper than that. Electrons are waves too. Matter is a wave. Everything is a wave. But quantum mechanics says that when we look at things carefully enough, they look like particles to us, not like waves. And that's just a deep, profound, weirdly non-intuitive feature of reality that we have to get used to understanding.
Because it's one thing to just accept that, well, I guess we can think about light in these two different ways, but it is a really different implication to realize that actually that applies to everything. And it's not just about accepting we can think about it in these two ways. There's sort of a reason why.
Yeah, that's right. And it's, again, very wonderfully unifying when you do get it. The fact that the world is made of waves, in fact, it's made of fields in particular, is an enormously strong feature of our understanding. It really helps us delineate the scope of our understanding. And I've written, you know, blog posts trying to drive this home about how ultimately quantum field theory shows you that things like telekinesis or life after death are impossible without doing any double-blind experiments with, you know, people trying to bend spoons or anything like that. It just would violate quantum field theory as we understand it. And as a scientist, you can always say, well, maybe quantum field theory is not right, and that's absolutely true, but it is the best tested framework for doing physics that has ever been developed. So if you think that you see someone bending a spoon and you say, well, either that guy is tricking me, or all of the known laws of physics as tested in every experiment ever done are somehow incorrect, then your prior probability should be a lot bigger on the first one compared to the second.
Yeah, you're probably going to know pretty quickly which way things are leaning. You mentioned energy, and take us back to our fifth graders again for a second. You're really careful in the book about how you use the word energy, and like talking about matter, we often talk about it in, you know, sort of simplified ways when we first introduce students to these ideas. And we often talk about different forms of energy. You can find that in a lot of school textbooks, kinetic, potential, and on from there. Do you think that kind of understanding about energy is helpful as an introduction, or does it kind of hinder looking at these more complex relationships between mass and energy?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't really necessarily know the answer to that one. I think that's an empirical question that people should study, because I know that in my own attempts to talk about science, all the time I get these, you know, this moment of realization where I've been using a word and it finally dawns on me the person listening to me is using the same word to mean something very different, whether it's energy or dimension or force or what have you. So I don't know the answer. I think that energy is a very important concept. We should teach it to the fifth graders. Richard Feynman has a wonderful little lecture about this where he points out that in some sense we say that energy is conserved. And the definition of energy is this thing that is conserved that we calculate in a certain way, right? And, you know, if we found that energy wasn't conserved, we would try to come up with some other place where the non-conserved energy went. And it is a fortunate feature of the world in which we live that there is such a conservation law, and it does work to help us understand things. There's something that is not created or destroyed. And that becomes more complicated when we have gravity and the expansion of the universe and things like that. But to the fifth grade level, I think it makes a lot of sense to at least teach people about the concept that there's this stuff that only moves around. It doesn't actually come into existence or go away. And we call it energy.
And you're pretty clear that that doesn't apply in exactly the same way when we talk about conservation of mass. So we have to be a little more careful with that.
Yeah, right? That's exactly right, because mass is just a form of energy. And when energy is conserved, it can nevertheless be transposed. That's not the right word, but changed, transformed from one type of energy to another. So if mass is one type of energy, there's nothing at all that stops us from transforming it into another type. And the most manifest example of this would be an atomic bomb. That is taking the mass energy of the nuclei inside and converting it to the heat energy of the explosion. And that's what we do all the time. Whenever we have some chemical reaction, ultimately one form of energy is changing into another type, and mass is just one of those forms.
Part of the accounting process.
Exactly right, yeah.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with Sean Carroll, physicist and author of The Particle at the End of the Universe. So one of the things I thought was really interesting about the book, it's, as we've talked about, there's a lot of very big ideas in there, but you seem to have taken a strategy of a bit of a spiral. You sort of give a little introduction to some of the big ideas, then move to some stories about the people and the building of the LHC, and then sort of back to these big ideas and kind of spiral around. Was that a conscious choice to do it that way?
It's so nice to have an actual writer read the book and notice all of these things. So, yes, actually, that was a very explicit choice because of, you know, it's just one of these subjects where you can't understand any bit of it without understanding the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to write yet another book that starts by explaining the basics of quantum mechanics and the list of particles in the Standard Model and so on. I wanted to get the reader excited about, you know, this giant project that was going on underground in Switzerland and France. But to understand what the project was doing, you need to understand something about those particles that everyone explains. So it was a little bit of a give and take, you know, just enough about the basic particles so you can understand why the experiment was doing that, and then just enough about the experiments you could learn what you wanted to test with the particles, and then back to some of the nuts and bolts about how the experiment worked. And I think that it's a good illustration of the fact that in the real world, experiment and theory and engineering and publicity, for that matter, are all part of a single scientific process. We put them in different boxes in our minds when we talk about them, but it's all the same thing, and that's reflected in the structure of the book.
That's actually really neat. I sort of thought of it from talk about our fifth graders again. I sort of thought about in curriculum planning, we try to do that. But I actually hadn't thought about the fact that it does reflect in a way how science happens as well. It sort of is a constant back and forth between how it happens, why it happens, and what we're actually doing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And to be honest and fair, I'm married to a writer who keeps telling me that writing a book is different than giving a one semester long college course where you more or less have a captive audience and can build everything up logically from one step to the other because you know the payoff will be there at the end. You know, in a popular book, it's good to have some payoff right there at the beginning, you know, to get people interested and to get them going. And I do think that, you know, in thinking about how to do that, it is actually a more accurate reflection of how the process of science really works. So hopefully some of that came through to the readers, you know, who aren't working scientists themselves.
Mm-hmm. I found actually another one of the themes of the book was actually, it was a little bit about how we theorize about these things. Like, how do we actually propose theories and gather evidence to support them in these kinds of very, very deep questions? Am I sort of right in seeing that that was one of the themes running through it?
Yeah, I mean, definitely one of the subtexts of the book is that science is something that scientists do, and scientists are human beings, and we don't have any sort of robotic algorithm for coming up with theories, just like we don't have a robotic algorithm for, you know, wheedling treasury secretaries into giving money to build large particle accelerators. There's a bit of inspiration that is not quite reducible to a simple procedure. And in particular, I have one long chapter in the book that talks about the very explicit history of how the ideas behind the Higgs mechanism were developed over time. And it's, you know, the most technical chapter in that book because you have to be fair to everyone who did all this hard work, which means you explain exactly what they did. And when you're doing something for the first time, you're not doing it in exactly the most clear or correct way, right? Because you're fumbling around at what to do. So, you know, part of it is, why didn't this guy think of this thing? Why didn't he talk to the person down the hall who was working on that? And, you know, it's very amusing to see how the real people come across these things. You know, I borrowed a little anecdote from a book by Frank Close, where two people at Imperial College were talking to each other about their work, and one of them, you know, starts explaining his new idea, and the other one says, no, never tell anyone your ideas until they're published. And, of course, if he had told him that idea, they both would have invented the Standard Model long before Steven Weinberg had got there, because they each had half of the answer and not the whole one. So it's a mixed bag, you know, these lessons that you learn from your mentors, and that's part of the human process.
I think I may have said no when I read that part. It's like watching the characters.
I'm sure he did too.
Yeah, probably. We have a question from the chat. JT512 asks, what books would you recommend for someone who wanted to learn the basics of quantum field theory?
There aren't any that I would really recommend. That's a very hard question because, like I said, quantum field theory is the thing we don't really popularize very explicitly. So there are two books that I can recommend. Neither of them is perfect, but Present Company Accepted, of course. I've written a book. Did people know that? And quantum field theory is there, but it's, again, not the point of the book. The other two books are Richard Feynman wrote a short book called QED, about quantum electrodynamics. And QED, quantum electrodynamics, is a field theory, certainly. It's not the only field theory. There's lots of other ones, but it's a very good example. And Feynman, as usual, is very clear and very imaginative about digging into the guts of what is going on. So it's definitely enlightening. And the other one is that book by Frank Close I just mentioned called The Infinity Puzzle. And it's about the history of quantum field theory, but he gets into a lot of the details, and especially the question of infinities and renormalization and how we learn to make sense of quantum field theory. So I don't think the perfect pocket guide to field theory all by itself has yet been written. If someone gives me $1 million, maybe I will do that.
That sounds good.
Sounds unlikely, but it'd be good, yes.
It's waiting to be written.
Right.
So there's been a couple of stories recently about what it means for these big projects like the LHC when they find what they're looking for. That sort of by confirming this last major piece of the Standard Model, what happens next? The Atlantic, I think, wrote kind of a cheeky headline recently, "Physicist bummed that physics is pretty much what they expected."
Right.
And you stress in the book that surprises are really, you know, really important, and it's motivating when we find something unexpected. But I don't get the feeling that you're bummed. Can you wrap us up here with some thoughts on where this is going and why it's actually maybe a beginning rather than just an end?
Yeah. Well, you know, part of it is people are enormously impatient. I mean, we've been looking for the Higgs boson for 48 years, and we found it for less than 6 months ago. And people are now saying, well, what have you done for me lately? We found the Higgs boson, but there's nothing else. You know, it's very, very, well, at least possible. I still think it's likely that the LHC is going to find more than just the Higgs boson. Mm. It is, to be very honest, it's been... It is certainly true that the LHC could have already found a lot more than the Higgs boson and hasn't yet. So there are some possibilities that could have been right 2 years ago that are certainly wrong from our current perspective. But they found one thing. They're collecting a lot more data. The machine is working incredibly well. In a couple months, they're going to turn it off, shut it down for 2 years while they tighten all the screws and clean all the wires. And then it's going to come back in 2015 at a higher energy, almost twice the energy that it had this year. So once again, it will be very possible that it's going to find things. But, you know, think about how hard it was to find the Higgs, and we've been looking for exactly that for a really long time. Mm-hmm. So I'm certainly not in any way pessimistic that we won't find anything more. If we don't find anything more at the LHC, then, you know, we're just going to have to try to be more clever. We know for a fact that the Standard Model of particle physics is not the end of the story, because we know there's something called dark matter in the universe, and dark matter is not in the Standard Model of particle physics. So we need to do something better. And I would admit, if it weren't for dark matter, then I would be worried a little bit. But there's dark matter. So I know that there's got to be physics that we don't understand yet. And it's just a matter of being smart enough to find it.
Very cool. Thanks so much, Sean. It's really terrific to speak with you today about the Higgs, the LHC, and the importance of even asking these questions.
My pleasure. I had a lot of fun.
The Particle at the End of the Universe is one part lesson in particle physics, one part social history of the Higgs, and one part testament to the importance of asking these big questions. You can find a link to it and to Sean's other projects on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And while you're there, click the links to the Facebook, Twitter, and Google Plus so you can keep up with show news, and to iTunes where you can subscribe to our program or listen to past episodes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.